And we're back with another segment of The Reporter's File. Hello everyone, many thanks for joining us. First off, the headlines. Israel's illegal activities on Palestinian land. Asia's seventh most popular tourist destination in India. A disaster unfolding in the wetlands of Kashmir. And the menace of drugs in Afghanistan. There has been a significant rise in the number of villages being erected throughout the West Bank in protest at the Israeli authorities building new settler units on the land. The settler units cut the West Bank into two, separating Palestinians from their Jerusalem al-Quds neighbors. Nellie Burton starts us off.
The E1 area has become the most controversial and disputed area of land in Palestine, as Israel have made plans to build an illegal settlement of thousands of homes for Jewish-only settlers. In a bid to claim back this land, Palestinian activists, with permission from Palestinian landowners, built a small village of tents. The new creative form of activism has taken hold around the West Bank, with the popular committee organizing protest villages in Bab el-Shams, the Gate of the Sun, Bab el-Karama, the Gate of Dignity, and more recently on land in Nablus.
For the strategy with him, this one of the method of the popular struggle to against the Israeli and the apartheid, how we can to stop the strategy of the settlement and the settlers in the West Bank, and enough for the long incubation of the world. We want to change for the method to against the incubation and the Israeli occupation.
They have a big army. I mean, when we started nonviolent resistance 10 years ago, we started with one spot, and they said it's only just one spot, and then it became 10, and then 20, and then 50. And now what you see here is a merger between all these local nonviolent movements into one big Palestinian stream. If they attack us, if they destroy the tents here, we'll create another one. And if they destroy a village, we'll create two other villages.
In the village of Bab el-Karama, residents attempted to build a new Palestinian village and a mosque in protest against the Israeli army, erecting a wall which will take over 96% of their land. Just another Palestinian protest village destroyed at the hands of the Israeli army. As you can see by the devastation in front of me, the Israeli army stormed the village at 3 o'clock in the morning, destroying this mosque. Now, in their steadfastness, the Palestinians are reacting by planting 400 new olive trees in the area. Although the Israeli army continued to demolish these protest villages under the pretext of security, Palestinians state they are creating these villages to highlight to human rights groups and to the international community the continuous land grabs and ethnic cleansing by Israeli authorities.
The wall was separated the majority of the land. About 1,200 hectares from Beit Iksa land. And it just leaves about 2,000 hectares for the city, for the village itself. This is what had happened, and this is what they are looking to do it. The train that passes from near here in this neighborhood was passed from the lands of Beit Iksa. And the Israelis want to keep the citizens here far away from the base of the train and the wall. That's why they separate the land is close to the Israelis, and just they make this ring around the houses of Beit Iksa.
The owner of the land in Bab el-Shams currently resides in Jerusalem and has organized a case in the High Court of Justice against the Israeli authorities attempting to claim his family's land in order to expand the E1 settlements.
من منطقة الطور لأن هذه الأراضي هي تابعة لمنطقة الطور.
The identification papers prove that the Palestinian families own this land and the deeds date back to the Ottoman Empire. These papers have been passed through seven families, including Abu Jama'a and Al Ghanem. We reject the Israelis claiming it's their land.
Abu Ghanem showed Press TV the full deeds of the land owned by his family from the early Ottoman period until now.
When the Israeli government saw the Bab al-Shams, they used all of their force against the people in Bab al-Shams and destroyed the land. We took this to the High Court to approve it as a private land, alongside going to the Jerusalem municipality to approve the new village. We were able to get the decision not to remove the tents for 6 days. However, the Israeli army took steps to evacuate people in the area under this pretext that it was a military zone.
Abu Ghanem further explained that the Israeli army gained permission to evacuate the people for a period of 48 hours and then to demolish the tents after another 48 hours. However, there are no military training camps in the area and no residents living in the area. The Abu Ghanem family are now prosecuting the Israeli army in the High Court based on this decision and to validate their ownership of the land in the eyes of the international community. Nell Burden for Reporters File, Occupied West Bank.
A city of forts and palaces where tradition and culture have remained intact for centuries is now bringing thousands of tourists to India every year. Also known as India's Pink City, Jaipur is Asia's seventh biggest tourist hub. Shahana Butt reports.
The person who travels to Jaipur for the first time gets a feeling as if time has traveled back to 18th century because the city has maintained its heritage appearance. One of the oldest cities in India, Jaipur, was founded by Maharaja Shivaji Singh II in 17th century and based it on Indo-Persian architecture. Later in 18th century, the city was painted pink to welcome Edward, Prince of Wales. Since then, it has remained dressed into the same color. The city of Jaipur in the Indian state of Rajasthan has been designed in such a way that it unfolds the wider perspective of the designer. The city was divided into 9 blocks, of which 2 contain the state buildings and palaces, and the remaining 7 were allotted to the public. Huge fortification walls along with 7 strong gates continue to give it an appearance of royal city. The main attraction of the city is its forts and palaces, which are maintained in such a way as if have been made overnight. Each day, tens of thousands of tourists arrive in the city for sightseeing, which is the main source of income for the people of Jaipur. Meena Lal drives a taxi. The only source of income for him is the money generated from tourists. Meena says each day he makes $40 to $50, and more often it depends on the tourist.
My work never stops because tourists come to Jaipur round the year, and I am happy because my children are studying in a good school. Now I want to grow in this business. I am trying to save as much as I can so that I can start my own rent-a-car business.
The other attractions of this heritage city are its handicrafts, furniture and jewellery. Jaipur falls in a rich mineral belt of marble, precious and semi-precious stones, which makes it a unique marketplace for both raw and finished products. Jewelry of precious and semi-precious stones is a strong attraction for tourists.
Actually, right now the business is, according to before, the business is going lower because of the economy of Europe. All the economy of Europe is getting lower. But the economy from Asia, like China or Korea, they are coming a lot right now. So maybe in the future the economy will be going up, but right now the business is not that much good. Mostly tourists, not the local people are like handmade things, but the tourists, the tourism from another countries, they like handmade things more. So whatever, whenever they come, they just ask what is the handmade, we want to buy that one, not the machinery one, because the same machinery things they can buy in their country also.
Moreover, Jaipur is also home to gold and silver jewellery made in the Kundan and Meenakari traditions, which are now world famous. Apart from magnificent architecture and exquisite handicrafts, Jaipur is famous across India for its turbans. Turbans worth millions of dollars are made and used in India during festivals and ceremonies, and this way helping people create employment avenues. Rakesh has set his business near a temple in the main town of Jaipur and makes different types of turbans depending upon the orders he receives. He initiated it all alone. Today he has a group to provide him helping hand.
We chose this location deliberately. One, because we don't have to pay rent. Second, lot of people come to the temple, and those who require turbans usually buy from us. Many a times people tell us to make it on spot, and we do it. Sometimes we receive orders of religious ceremonies, sometimes marriage ceremonies, and in this way we manage our business.
Jaipur is in itself a small, colorful world which continues to attract people from across the globe just because it has been able to maintain its ages-old culture and tradition. And in this way, India generates a lot of revenue from its tourism industry. Tourism is one of the largest industries of India. The World Travel and Tourism Council said tourism generated $121 billion, or 6.4% of the nation's GDP, and was responsible for 39.3 million jobs. In a 2011 forecast, the World Travel and Tourism Council predicted the annual growth to be 8.8% between 2011 and 2021. This gave India the fifth rank among countries with the fastest growing tourism industry. Shahana Bhatt, Reporters File, Jaipur.
Indian-administered Kashmir is blessed with wetlands of global importance, wetlands that are host to millions of exotic migratory birds every year. But these natural treasures are dying a slow death because of indifference and negligence on the part of the authorities.
Every year during winter period, the wetlands across Indian-controlled Kashmir come to life as they host tens of thousands of migratory birds that undertake their long seasonal flights, winging their way through never-ending power grids across entire continents, covering the vast expanse of the planet. These days, the region's wetlands are abuzz with chirping of the migratory birds that have flocked in from as far as Siberia, Europe and Central Asia as part of their annual sojourn, flying thousands of miles to spend winter in various wetland reserves in the Himalayan region.
We have some 115 species of birds here. Some are resident, some are migratory. Among the migratory, we have this mallards, teals, pintail, gadwal, grey-leg geese, tufted duck.
Hogarsar, Wular, Narkara, Mirgund and Shalabug wetlands are some of the notable bird habitats in this region. These wetlands host several species of migratory birds that come here on the onset of winter.
But not everything is hunky-dory as far as the migratory birds and wetlands in this region are concerned. Over a period of time, the refuge lands of these avian visitors have been under attack on various fronts. The massacre of migratory birds continues unabated, and the vanishing wetlands are posing a serious threat to the survival of these birds in this region.
With the migratory birds flocking to the region, poachers too are back in action. The unabated massacre of avian visitors by professional hunters is going on predominantly in Hokarsar and Wular wetlands in collusion with some unscrupulous elements. The hunting of birds was banned in 1990s with the eruption of armed resistance against India in this conflict-torn region. However, the massacre of winged visitors continues unabated due to alleged official patronage. A young Kashmiri environment lawyer and activist says that poaching has picked up alarmingly and hundreds of migratory birds are being mowed down within their habitat. With the result, the influx of these avian visitors has drastically decreased over the years.
The Section 8 of Wildlife Protection Act categorically bans hunting, poaching of any of its kind, but still it is prevalent in the state of Jammu and Kashmir to a very large extent. It is surprising and shocking to all of us that the law was passed in 1978 and till today, we don't have a single conviction of any of the person involved in any poaching incident.
Nadeem says there were around 1,600 wetlands in Kashmir, and now the figure has come down to 10.
As far as the number of wetlands we used to have is, as far as the historical documents, whether small or big, the number used to be around 1,600 wetlands. But right now we are just focusing on 9 to 10 wetlands which are under the notification of Wildlife Department.
Hega, one of the premier wetlands in Kashmir, has been reduced to almost half its original size of 7.25 square kilometers. Hogarsar wetland has a similar tale to tell. The famous wetland over the years has shrunk to 4.5 square kilometers compared to its original area of 13.74 square kilometers. Willard Lake and Dal Lake have also shrunk to 58.71 square kilometers and 12 square kilometers respectively compared to their original size of 157.74 square kilometers and 75 square kilometers respectively. Mirgun wetland has also been reduced to 1.5 square kilometers compared to its original size of 4.5 square kilometers. Experts believe that unchecked urbanization, deforestation, silt deposition, encroachment, and dismissive and apathetic attitude of the concerned authorities have brought these wetlands to the brink of extinction, endangering the migratory birds. Ironically, Hogarsar and Willard are listed as important wetlands of international repute under the Ramsar Convention signed on 2nd of February 1971 by the delegates of 18 countries at a meeting held in Caspian Seaside Resort of Ramsar in Iran.
Ramsar has they have identified throughout the world the wetlands which are at the verge of their extinction. So it is not only the on the basis of the extinction of the wetlands, it's on the basis of the extinction of the biodiversity they contain.
Notwithstanding the repeated pleas of the environmentalists to protect the vanishing wetlands, the authorities have done very little or nothing to safeguard these natural treasures. Worse, the government is setting up a housing colony at an erstwhile wetland, Rakarat, which has also threatened the existence of adjoining Hogarsar wetland.
There are a good number of wetlands which have almost vanished. First, if you see in the Bemina area, we had a very good number of wetlands. Those areas are almost now gone because all those areas have been now converted into the residential areas. Rakarat was basically a wetland. Now it has been converted into a landmass. Now it is no more a wetland now.
Shah says the construction of dams around wetlands and cultivation of paddy in erstwhile wetlands have adversely impacted the ecosystem and habitats of the migratory birds.
Amidst the official apathy and the sorry state of affairs on the ground, Kashmir's wetlands desperately need a godfather that will restore their pristine glory. Otherwise, these gifts of nature bestowed on the valley are on the verge of being consigned to the dustbins of history. Said Ali Safi for Reporters File, Indian Controlled Kashmir.
Apart from an ongoing war, insecurity and unemployment, Afghans are facing a drug addiction crisis. The number of the addicts is rising by the day. And figures show that nearly 2 million drug addicts live their lives in horrible conditions. Amin Alami has our final report.
Narcotics in Afghanistan is one of the most serious problems in the country, and now there are many questions about this issue. For example, about social, cultural and economic impact of drugs, or how the cultivation, use and smuggling of narcotics has witnessed an upward trend despite the presence of US and its allies in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting poppy cultivation and terrorism for the past 11 years.
Based on the statistics, the number of drug addicts in Afghanistan was very low before the coming of US and NATO troops, and the narcotics were mainly for export. But after more than 11 years, poverty, joblessness and killing of Afghan civilians by both the US troops and Taliban militants, and of course their involvement in Afghanistan's narcotics issue, have turned into a main cause for increasing of drug addiction in the war-ravaged country. Jawad blames the US, UK and the Taliban for increasing of drug addiction among the Afghan society.
In our country, the US, UK and Taliban are involved in cultivation and trafficking of opium, and unfortunately the government is too weak to prevent this illegal business.
Apart from Jawad, there are thousands of such drug addicts in Kabul. Most of them are homeless. Hundreds of these addicts have lost some of their family members in US or Taliban attacks across the country. Ghulam Farooq has been a strong and healthy farmer, he remembers, but he has been forced to leave his village in eastern Kandahar province after US bombing killed all of his family members. This loss and the psychological impacts of the mentioned US airstrike has led him to addiction.
I have lost all of my family members in a US air attack on our village in Kandahar. We were only working on our fields. We had no links to any terrorist group. I abandoned my village to save my life and forget the tragedy.
It is said that the lack of strict measures on the issue of straggling against poppy cultivation in Afghanistan has caused the leading of over 1.5 million Afghans, most of them youth or even children, to drug addiction, and it will undoubtedly undermine all claims of US and NATO regarding to straggling against poppy cultivation in Afghanistan.
Although fighting against poppy cultivation in Afghanistan was believed to be part of the US campaign, but there has been less progress in this fight. The increase in opium cultivation has greatly affected the lives of our people and made thousands of young Afghans addicted to opium.
The rising number of drug addicts and growth of narcotics trafficking from Afghanistan has created severe concerns among the regional and international counter-narcotics organizations.
According to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, no other country in the world produces as much heroin, opium and hashish as Afghanistan. The UN's claim is indisputable, since this devastating malaise has beset over 1.5 million of the people in Afghanistan on the one hand and damaged the image of the US and UK as the supporter of the war against poppy cultivation in this country on the other.
The waste of a large amount of money by drug addicts in Afghanistan is considered as one of the other outcomes of mismanagement of narcotics crisis in the country. Figures show that each one of nearly 2 million drug addicts in Afghanistan spend at least $1 every day to provide himself or herself with heroin, poppy or hashish. The result is the waste of over $1.5 million every day in a country which is facing severe economic challenges. While the poppy cultivation and drug addiction in Afghanistan has turned into an international problem, but Afghan officials are optimistic to prevent the rest of millions of Afghan nationals from becoming addicts. They also consider the creation of over 50 drug treatment centers across Afghanistan as an effective step to return drug addicts into their normal life.
Along with the creation of over 54 drug treatment centers across the country, we could return hundreds of drug addicts, most of them between 16 to 25, to their normal life, and we hope to help more drug addicts.
Most of Afghanistan's poppy is being cultivated in southern Helmand, Kandahar and Farah provinces. We are known as the Taliban's stronghold, and now, as much as Afghans are getting closer to the year 2014 as the time for withdrawal of all foreign troops, Afghans are hopeful to be the witness of implementation of counter-narcotics operations by the Afghan government across the country. They believe the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan will force the Taliban to put their guns on the ground and join to the peace process. In this case, they do not need to support the poppy cultivation for their economic aims for fighting. Reporting for Reporters File, Amin Alami, Kabul.
And that's all for this segment of the Reporter's File. Many thanks for watching us, everyone. Make sure to join us again right here on Press TV next week as well. Until then, goodbye.